It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Defense Department announced plans today to cut the U.S. Army to its smallest size since before World War II. We'll get more details about that plan after 5:30.
But first, a reporter from the Gannett, Wisconsin Media Investigative Team is giving us a preview of their series on Native American casinos. Yesterday, Gannett Papers posted the first part of its seven-part series called Doubling Down, the Great Divide in Indian Gaming.
Native American casinos are a huge part of Wisconsin's culture and economy, especially for tribes. The topic is more timely now as Governor Scott Walker continues to weigh the Menominee tribe's plan to open a new casino in Kenosha. Here to talk about the series and what they found is Katie Foodie. She's a reporter for Gannett, Wisconsin Media Investigative Team. Katie, welcome to the show.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, as I mentioned, the timing of this is pretty good with the controversy over that casino in Kenosha, but you've had this in the works for a while. Why did your team decide to take a closer look at these casinos?
You know, it came where I think many stories come from. An editor in Wausau had visited a casino and realized how much the industry had changed since the last time he had been there. So that's really what got us rolling, and then we realized, you know, we had really hit this benchmark of about 25 years since gaming really got started nationally, and maybe a little bit more than that for Wisconsin, because it was happening here already, sort of as a traditional and fundraising mechanism for many tribes.
Well, if you can, give us a taste of what kind of angles you're covering in this series, and we'll delve a little deeper into them as we go along.
Yeah, I think the story that we posted yesterday really gives you a good overview of the difference that this has made for tribes in general. I don't think anyone can tell you that life for them is the same as it was before gaming got started. We are talking about millions of dollars, even for tribes that aren't as successful as some of the most successful tribes that we found. But there is a definite disparity. You know, some are able to bring in around $4 million, $5 million that they then put into their government operations, and others are making more than $200 million. So it's quite a difference, and you can really see that in the services and other things that they're able to offer to their members.
Well, let's follow that, actually. Tell us about the two tribes you compared. Both came out of poverty, as you wrote, but to very differing degrees. Paint us a picture of what life looks like on the two, with the two tribes that you looked at.
We took a look yesterday at the Menominee tribe, who obviously have been in the news quite a bit because of their Kenosha proposal, and the Oneida Nation. There is about 35 miles, I think, separating them, but you can really see the difference in what that has meant for them. Location is such an important factor when you're talking about an industry that depends on foot traffic, and the Oneidas being in Green Bay, very close to Lambeau and right across the street from the airport there, has definitely made a difference for them. You know, they're bringing in more than $100 million that they're able to put into government services, versus the Menominee, who last year were able to put about $8 million toward government services. Some of the things we're going to get into is the healthcare services that they're able to offer. The Oneida, for example, have a facility that's about 10 years old. You know, all the latest equipment, and the Menominee are doing okay, but, you know, they certainly have disadvantages. Their clinic has been able to grow over time, but one example that their health administrator gave me was that they just got a pill counting machine, and it's a very simple piece of equipment, but they got it about 5 years later than everyone else just because of the resource issue.
How quickly did, you mentioned it's about a 25-year benchmark, how quickly did the casinos spring up around the state?
They were not what we think of as casinos. You know, most of them were bingo halls to start off with, maybe one room, often very temporary structures that have hung on and hung around. Many of them still exist, and they're used kind of as auxiliary buildings at existing casinos. But it did happen very quickly because tribes looked at this as really a savior for them. Once the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act was passed, they knew that they were now required to work with the state to negotiate compacts. So So there was kind of a gray period where casinos were being operated before those compacts were signed. One tribe official at the time said that their attorney said, well, if they, you know, if they come in and arrest you, then I promise I'll get you out, basically. So it was definitely an uncertain time for everyone involved.
What was life like for people of these tribes before the money started coming in from the casinos?
What we heard is that it was basically focused on just getting by. There was a lot of dependence on hunting, gathering, all, you know, really things that you could do for free, and kind of living off the land that was granted in these trust agreements to provide tribes with reservations. The Menominee, for example, several members told us that the entire area didn't have electricity until the 90s. So really things that were taken for granted in the rest of the state, they were still struggling to provide and then keep up. You know, housing definitely has improved as federal and state aid has increased and just been better used, too. I think tribe members would say that they've learned a lot in the last 25 years as well about kind of the best things that they can do to provide for members, even when resources are short.
When we look at a tribal budget, how big a role does money from casinos play?
We found that it still plays an enormous role. Menominee, for example, get at least 3/4 of their governing budget from gaming. Even a tribe like the Forest County Potawatomi, who really do have the most diverse kind of business portfolio of the tribes that we looked at, are still getting about 80% of their government revenue from gaming operations. And there's no denying from tribe officials and members that they're continuing to work at that. But, you know, opening a business is not going to be as immediately profitable as opening a casino was. So there is a little bit of an expectation adjustment that members are having to make, and they also want to be safe with their, you know, basically tax dollars. That's what they have at their fingertips to use, so they want to make sure that ventures tribe officials are pursuing are going to pan out.
Is there a worry, though, that there are too many eggs in that one basket, that if something in the economy changes, if more competition opens up, that they'll be back where they were before casinos or closer to that?
I think there's some confidence among tribe members that you could take gaming away or minimize it, and they would find a way to get by. But, you know, we heard from one member that he's hoping that doesn't happen in his lifetime because he'd be the one trying to figure out how to fill that hole. But it's definitely an industry that has a lot of question marks, and one of our stories focuses on that, especially what online gaming could mean. As we've talked about the Kenosha Project, what more competition as tribes pursue off-reservation casinos could mean. So I think there are still a lot of unknowns.
Is there a concern, yeah, with a new casino like the one proposed in Kenosha, that there's going to be diminishing returns? Ultimately, there are only so many people who are going to go and gamble at a casino.
Yeah, and it's a tough thing to get a handle on. One of the things I was surprised about is that most of the studies of this area and the industry as a whole are done by one side or another. You know, those that support gaming as an industry, maybe industry groups even, and groups that oppose the, you know, the entire idea or oppose expansion of gaming. So it's tough to really get a handle on exactly what will happen, but we've certainly heard from the Potawatomi and the Ho-Chunk that they believe a Kenosha casino will cut into what they're able to do at their existing facilities. And, you know, the Menominee would argue that they're trying to make every effort to minimize that.
We're talking about casinos operated by tribes here in Wisconsin with Katie Foody. She's a reporter for the Gannett, Wisconsin Media Investigative Team.
What do you think about tribal casinos in Wisconsin? We'd like to hear from you now. Do you think they're good for our state's economy? And what about the tribes in Wisconsin? Do you have questions about casinos in Wisconsin? Well, you can call now at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@WPR.org.
We'll continue the conversation in just a minute right after a look at the headlines with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our conversation now about tribal casinos with Katie Foodie, reporter for the Gannett, Wisconsin Media Investigative Team.
And we want to hear from you. What do you think about tribal casinos here in the state? Do you think they're good for the state's economy? Are they good for the tribes that operate them? Why or why not? Do you have questions about Wisconsin's casinos? Give a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Kitty on the line with us in Milwaukee. Kitty, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
I wanted to say that I believe it is good for the Wisconsin and also for the tribes because wherever there's a casino located, it draws in more tourists, so it helps the tourism economy, but it also creates a lot of jobs, not just for tribal members, but for other people living in that area locally. And I think in general, it's a boost to the economy wherever a casino is located.
Katie, thanks for the call. Katie, I don't know if you look into that in the series, is there an effect outside the tribes into local communities?
What we heard, I think there were two tribes that were good examples of that. The Potawatomi, who have many members who live in Forest County, and also the Ho-Chunk, who Bill Leaders at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism reported on. I should mention that they partnered with us on this project. And we did hear a lot from people who work in tourism, people who work in small business, and in local government that when you have a strong tribe, which typically means that their gaming operation is strong, they help the entire area. So whether that's the Potawatomi taking part in an economic development effort for Forest County, that was really, you know, the first project of its kind, or the Ho-Chunk, who really contribute to the Wisconsin Dells tourism environment, there's certainly a local appreciation for the industry.
I wanted to hear a little more about where casino revenue ends up. You mentioned things like health clinics on various reservations. What else happens with the money? Is there, or is it not one size fits all? Different tribes do different things with the money.
Absolutely. Different tribes do different things. One of the biggest conversations that we found happening, even 25 years after this industry really got started, was how much to depend on direct payments to individual tribe members. You know, I heard time and time again that it's really a philosophical call, that some tribes believe it's just a new form of welfare and, you know, you're teaching people to be dependent on something rather than kind of going out and finding their own, you know, industry or something that they want to be involved in. But tribes that have used this system, including the Potawatomi, argue that that money is going back into the local economy. Members are using it to buy cars, televisions, groceries, you name it, and it's, you know, supporting the area as a whole. And we certainly heard that from business owners around those communities too.
Who regulates these casinos? Is it the tribes themselves, the states, the feds? I have no idea how that works.
Yeah, it's really a multi-layered process and actually is very complicated, which certainly has changed, you know, over time. For example, the tribes themselves monitor it just like any business would. The state monitors it. They have a whole department that's in charge of auditing those tribes. Those records weren't available to us because that's an agreement between the state and the tribes that was negotiated a long time ago that, you know, those competitive things won't be revealed, but we were able to find out a bit through federal records, and there's also the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which is really the main federal regulator, who's very involved in casino location decisions, as well as just making sure that things are running smoothly and appropriately.
We may not know the ins and outs exactly of casino budgets for the tribes, but we do know, I imagine, how much the state makes from it. How much of the state's budget comes from casino revenue?
You know, it's not a huge percentage of the state budget, but we found that over the last 10 years or so, the median amount was about $50 million. Another reporter who worked on this series with me really found that property tax relief is the biggest tie-in to this, and that's really about the state lottery. Andy Thompson's story ran today, and he was able to take a look at really how that 1987 referendum that allowed a lottery kind of allowed the casino industry to really flourish and bring us to where we are today, where we have 25 scattered around the state.
Go back to our callers now. We've got Mike with us in Appleton. Hi, Mike.
Good afternoon. Before casino gambling came to Brown County and through the Oneidas, you would hear people in Brown County say, on Broadway, especially in West Green Bay, oh, those drunken Indians, they're bums, they don't do anything, they're lazy, they've got nothing, they just leech off of us, da-da-da-da. Then came the Oneida gambling, which has been very, very well regulated. If it wasn't for the Oneidas, the west side of Green Bay would look totally different economically than it does today. They provide education for their own. They contribute to the community. They've helped a number of businesses, non-Indians, grow and flourish on West Mason Street. And so those same people who are griping about the Indians, as we all get in this state, people who hate Indians, now the gripe is, oh, those Indians, they got all that money. They don't share it, da-da-da-da. Why should they have it? I'm happy for the Oneidas. Okay. And I think if some of these tribes are having difficulty, maybe they're in an area where there's not that type of gaming, the size of it.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Is that a response that you think is common, Katie?
I think you hear a little bit of both. The Oneida are a very unique situation where they are kind of intermingled with the community. I mean, as you drive around that area, you know, one street you're on the reservation, the next you're off, because they've been able to buy back parcels as they become available. And in talking to members, they feel like that has pushed them to become part of the wider community a little bit more than maybe some other tribes that are located in rural locations. And sometimes when you have a contiguous reservation, there seems to be less need to kind of have the relationship that the Oneidas do with surrounding communities. You know, they talk a lot about the police and fire and ambulance service agreements that they've negotiated with surrounding communities and how that has really just made everyone see that there are another business interest there and that everyone's, you know, trying to do the best thing for the region as a whole.
Thanks for the call, Mike. We go now to Mike in Baraboo. Hi there, Mike.
Yes, good afternoon. Good topic. In fact, we were just discussing this here because I have a business right along Highway 12, not far from where the Ho-Chunk Casino is in Wisconsin Dells. And I was in a sort of a bidding war with a piece of property that was made available to us to actually grow the business that I currently have, and lost that piece of property to the nation, to Ho-Chunk, and who got the piece of property tax-free. They didn't pay any taxes on that property. And they don't consistently pay taxes to the level that I'm taxed. But yet, you know, I agree they probably do help their tribal members to some, you know, to some level. But they also make a substantial amount of money, and they have never been taxed appropriately to the level that myself and other business owners, and I employ about 50 employees in my business, but have never been taxed to the level that everybody else in the area has been taxed. But yet they make a profit.
There's gotcha, no Mike. I want to get a response from Katie about this. Is this a thing you hear from maybe businesses in the area of some casinos?
I think you do hear that, especially in the immediate area. You know, certainly there is the belief that things aren't quite as equitable, you know, as some people believe they should be. We heard that from some state lawmakers who said, you know, maybe we should be getting a little bit more in the compact payments. But there does also seem to be a belief that gaming is here to stay. And this is kind of the situation that we're in and need to kind of go along to get along as best as possible.
I bet if you'd asked someone 25 years ago, they wouldn't have thought that casinos would grow as quickly as they have in Wisconsin. What is, I know it's hard to answer this, but what is next? What are some of the big question marks in the future for Wisconsin casinos?
Well, you certainly have multiple tribes who are seeking the opportunity to expand. I think as many people might know, just because of the Kenosha debate, they need to get approval both from the federal government and from the governor. And Governor Walker has said that he's not going to make a decision quickly when it comes to the Kenosha proposal. But there are at least three other tribes who are pursuing opportunities like that. We can also really watch closely the online industry. We have two tribes here in Wisconsin who have joined an alliance that's really pushing for that to happen and to allow them to run online gaming just like any other business would be able to across the country. So there's a lot to watch in the coming years.
Katie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
That's Katie Foody, reporter for the Gannett, Wisconsin Media Investigative Team. She was with us to talk about their ongoing investigative series on Wisconsin's tribal casinos.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about a group of historians at the University of Wisconsin who played a key role in saving works of art from Nazis during World War II, our very own group of Monuments Men.
Before that, we're talking about the news today that Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel announced plans to scale back the United States Army to its lowest number since World War II. He also plans to cut military pay and benefits to save on personnel costs.
Some analysts are saying this is the first Pentagon budget to aggressively dial back spending from levels established after the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks.
Here to put this news into context and talk about how the budget will be received in Congress is Mika Oyang, director of the National Security Program for Third Way, a centrist think tank in Washington, D.C. Mika, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So as we mentioned earlier, analysts are saying this is the first Pentagon budget to dial back the increased military numbers the country has seen since 2001. How controversial is this proposal?
Well, elements of it are going to be very controversial, but the idea that the military is going to come down in size after we've wrapped up two wars is not that controversial.
So what part of it do you think people will be most concerned about, especially members of Congress who have to decide whether or not they give it the go-ahead?
I think that a lot of the proposals on personnel and compensation are going to be fairly controversial. And then for specific programs that are based in people's districts, those always provoke a fight from Congress.
So this proposal takes into account recent government austerity, and it also embraces President Barack Obama's promises to end our two big land wars. But neither of those things is particularly new. So why are we first seeing a budget like this now?
So the Pentagon is a very large bureaucracy, and they plan very far in advance. So it takes them a long time to react to world events. They just don't move quickly. So it's taken them a couple budget cycles to recognize that we are no longer in wartime. And so you're just seeing now a real reset of the force.
So you said making the Army smaller, scaling back the Army, is not something that you expect to be controversial. Why not?
Because the Army has increased in size to be able to accommodate the two wars that we have fought. The particular level will be a challenge for the military, and you will see some friction around specific units as they get cut. But the idea that overall it needs to come down, I think a lot of people understand that intellectually.
It does seem possible that a smaller army means increased casualties and also a longer road to success. So is the American public, and not to mention Congress, going to have trouble digesting that?
So the numbers themselves are a little misleading, because in addition to the reduction in the numbers, what you're seeing is a transformation in the kinds of ground forces that we have. There are a lot of people that are in the Army that are performing missions designed to fight the Cold War. They drive tanks. They are in missions that were designed to face the Soviet Union. Some of those things are going to go away, and in their place, you're seeing increases in the more modern, more agile forces that we have used to fight the war on terror. So you see increases in special forces. So overall, in terms of capability, we should come out of this more capable by reducing some of these legacy platforms.
And what about concerns that this could put the United States in a vulnerable position globally? Is any of that founded?
We are seeing for the first time the United States not really having a major security threat. We have a lot of small threats, and no one knows where the next threat is coming from. That uncertainty causes people some concern. But it's not like the Cold War, where we knew we were facing the Soviet Union, or even in the decade after 9/11, where we had an Al-Qaeda that was out there and constantly coming at us. Our government has done a very good job of taking down terrorist networks over the past 10 years. Now, that's not to say that work is over completely, but the challenge is very different.
Now, you said one of the things that this budget proposal does is get rid of some antiquated parts of the military. You mentioned fighting Cold War tanks and things like that, and that now we are relying increasingly on technology. And you use the word agile. So can you describe what this new era of the United States military will look like?
So you're seeing a lot of shift into unmanned platforms, into drones that allow people who are sitting safely in the United States to be able to drop bombs on the battlefield thousands of miles away. You see precision munitions that allow people to fly high above the range of adversaries' air defenses and still be very precise about where they're hitting targets. And you see very capable, highly trained special operations ground forces who are able to go in and sneak into countries unbeknownst to the host nation, do what they need to do, and get out again.
So in that sense, you know, some people are worried about increased casualties, but maybe are we living in an era where it's going to be less necessity for boots on the ground and by necessity from there, casualties? Maybe we're entering an era of technological warfare.
It depends on what kind of adversaries we're facing, but certainly we have seen the rate of casualties go down in every conflict that the United States has fought. That's not to say that every casualty that we suffer is very serious and is a tragedy, but the numbers of people who died in World War II and in Vietnam, the rates are much lower in these conflicts today.
Well, let's get to another aspect of this, limiting military pay raises as part of this, increasing the cost of health benefits and limiting housing options for soldiers. And this is something that you see as more controversial. Can you talk about what's happening with the benefits to the military in this budget?
Yeah, it's a real challenge for Secretary Hagel because the cost of benefits has increased dramatically in the 10 years since 9/11. Congress has rushed to take care of the troops, to raise their standard of living, to shift the cost that they had to bear. And even this has actually even started in the 90s with some of the TRICARE benefits. There's real political reluctance to remove any of those benefits, but now the military cost per individual troop is so high that it's squeezing out some of their other priorities. So the people have become so expensive. It's like what we see in other industries. The people have become so expensive that they're having to make hard choices between the numbers of people that they want and the other things that they can do. Secretary Hagel's trying to make some incremental cost reductions, but even those are going to be a big political challenge.
And in terms of retirement, that remains untouched, is that right?
For now, Congress made an attempt to trim retirement costs earlier this year and almost immediately reversed themselves under pressure from military service organizations, people who represent military families and retirees.
Well, the National Guard Association is already circulating talking points to Congress members, urging them to reject this proposal. How is it being received otherwise?
I think that a lot of members are very skeptical of any cuts to benefits for the troops. They feel like our service members have sacrificed, and they are entitled to these benefits, and it's one of the ways that a grateful nation can say thank you. However, for the Pentagon budgeters, it just poses a real challenge for them.
Well, even if the Pentagon doesn't succeed in getting this proposal approved, what does it say, do you think, about how the United States military could look down the road and its role in future conflicts?
I think that what you're going to see is a smaller military, and in part because of cost, and in part because as they become more effective, you need fewer people to cover the same amount of ground. Now, when you're talking about warfare, a certain amount of, as they say, quantity has a quality all its own, you need a certain amount of force on the ground to do what you need to do, but it really depends on the mission.
Mika, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Mika Ouyang, director of the National Security Program for Third Way, a centrist think tank in Washington, D.C. She was with us to talk about the news that the 2015 Pentagon budget will shrink the U.S. Army to its lowest levels since World War II. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. With the release of the film Monuments Men this month, Hollywood is shining a rare light on the work of archivists, librarians, and historians.
In the midst of World War II, as historic buildings were being bombed and art collections and museums looted across Europe, the United States sent a group of academics charged with protecting artifacts and returning them to their owners.
These soldiers were part of the Monuments, Fine Arts, and Archives section of the U.S. Army. They came to be known as the Monuments Men. The group grew over to 300, including women, by the way. They worked to find and return art long after the war was over.
The University of Wisconsin sent some of its own men as part of the mission, and UW Director of Archives David Null is here with us to share their stories. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So who were the Monuments Men?
The Monuments Men were basically people sent, as you said, academics from around the country who had backgrounds in art history and archives, in various fields to try to preserve cultural artifacts that were either being destroyed in Germany or were being, sometimes they were looted by the Nazis and were being stored often in underground mines. Sometimes they were things that were stored from museums. Sometimes they were just documents documenting the history of the Nazi government. And so people were sent over to sort of look for those things, to try to find them, to uncover them, save them. And there were several people who either worked at UW at the time or who later worked at UW who were part of that group.
Well, who were the people from UW? Let's go.
The main people from UW, Gilbert Doan, who was the director of the university libraries from 1937 to 1957, and he went into the Monuments Men unit in about 1943. We don't know a whole lot about what he did. He wrote a letter to the president of the university asking for leave, saying that he thought he was going to be working on preserving archives, libraries, and art museums in the occupied territories. But we don't have a lot of idea about what he did. Of course, it was classified at the time. The other main person from UW was Jess Bell. Gilbert Doan was besides the director of the library, after he left that position, became the first director of the university archives. Jess Bell was the second director of the university archives. He was working for the National Archives in Washington, D.C. during World War II and went into the Monuments Men also as part of that. His daughter, who lives here in Middleton, said she always wondered if he had much of a choice about going in since he was already working for the National Archives, but we're not sure about that. He worked a lot on documents that were found in salt mines in Germany, and my predecessor in the archives, Frank Cook, said Bell told him stories about trying to take documents out of the salt mines and having them starting to crumble, and they actually had to work in the mines to try to get the salt off of the documents and preserve the documents before they could take them up to the surface.
Wait, why were they hidden? Were they hidden in salt mines, or is that for some reason?
I don't think they were really hidden. I mean, there's sort of a couple of things going on, both with artwork and with documents. Some of the artwork was plundered. It was stolen from Jewish families, or the Nazis took it from various places. But some of it was just, they stored things from museums to try to keep them safe from bombings. And it was sort of the same way with some of their documents from the German government. They tried to just keep them safe as Berlin, other cities were being bombed. And so they stored them to try to keep those documents safe. And the U.S. and the Monuments Men was really a multinational effort, was trying to preserve those documents as records of what the Nazi government was doing.
Now, you talked about these two, Gilbert Doan and Jess Bell, as part of a Wisconsin contingent to the Monuments Men. Were they considered soldiers?
Basically, yes. I mean, I think Gilbert Doan had a rank of major when he retired, and we have a 2 or 3 page letter from Doan talking about going through sort of, wasn't really basic training, but they had to go through training to sort of tell them how to act as officers or how to act as people in a military setting where they weren't used to being in that type of a setting. And they had to do a lot, if you've seen the movie, they had to do a lot of sort of negotiating with people. They weren't always on the front lines, but they were trying to preserve art and history and documents at a time when people are fighting. And it's sort of not their highest priority always to preserve things or to make sure that something gets saved when they're trying to keep people from getting killed. And there were several other people who have Wisconsin connections, too, who were in the monuments bin. We know of at least five other people who have some connections to the university or to the state. Paul Vanderbilt, who was a longtime curator of photographs at the Wisconsin Historical Society, was also one of the monuments men.
Now, you said that a lot of what they went through seems to have been classified. Even the daughter of Jess Bell didn't really know the story. What do we know? What did filter down about their experience there?
Most of what's filtered down has come from sort of oral histories or talking to people. I know one of them actually published, one person not from the University of Wisconsin, published a memoir of sort of what he did during the war. A lot of it was, the movie makes it, I think, a little bit more dramatic than it probably was. I mean, they discovered that a lot of these things were being kept in salt mines. They had to figure out what was there. They had to sort of catalog it. They had to try to figure out where it came from, how to get it back to whatever museums or collections it came from. That was particularly difficult for artwork that was essentially stolen from Jewish families or places like that, where it's much harder to figure out where it came from as opposed to things from museums, which was easier. And so a lot of it, I think, was just sort of identifying what was there, trying to see what type of shape it was, and trying to figure out where it had actually come from and how to get it back to the places it came from.
Do you have a sense of how deeply they felt the importance of their mission there, how much the pieces of history, these documents, these works of art, how much it meant to them?
I think it mattered a lot to them. I mean, it's somewhat hard to tell, but they were all trained professionals in these fields, in archives, in libraries, in art history, and I think they felt deeply about what they were doing. I know Jess Bell's daughter said her father didn't talk much about his experiences, but that he felt very saddened and upset by the destruction in Germany and what he saw taking place there. And so I think they felt very much that they were trying to preserve very important cultural artifacts of civilization, of Western civilization. And I think they felt very strongly about that.
Now, there's still a lot of artwork, for instance, that is missing since World War II. Do you know whether this Monuments Men effort is still something that's ongoing?
I think in a sense it is. I mean, there's been a lot of news recently about sort of trying to repatriate, particularly, again, art stolen from Jewish families during World War II, and try to figure out how to get that back to people. The Nazis destroyed a lot of what they considered sort of degenerative art, more modern art, cubist art, things like that, that they didn't think were good art, and they destroyed a lot of that. But there certainly, I think, is still ongoing effort to try to figure out what art was actually taken, not so much from museums, but again, from private collections, particularly from Jews in Europe, and try to get that back to the people it came from.
Now, one of the two we've been talking about, I believe it was Gilbert, said their job was to keep the good stuff and get rid of the junk. How do they tell? I mean, I guess that's why you send trained archivists to the site, but how did they sort of sift through what they found?
That's still a problem for archivists, how you decide what's going to be important and what's going to be important in the future. And I'm sure they sort of use the same sort of appraisal techniques we have today of just trying to look at least large categories of documents and say, you know, these are things, you know, if it's something talking about budget, we probably don't care too much. If it's something talking about how the government worked, what was actually going on, that's something you care about. I'm sure they had to make sort of decisions based on large categories of documents and probably saved more perhaps than they needed to. But often that's what you end up doing to try to get the good things. You save more than maybe you have to save.
Now, you can imagine that for Jess and Gilbert, these two who had connections with UW, you said there were also an additional five, but coming back after the war must have been incredibly different. That must have been a once-in-a-lifetime experience for them. How did they reacclimate to academic life?
Again, it's somewhat hard to know. You don't hear a lot about that. Again, they didn't talk a lot about it. I know just physically, again, Jess Bell's daughter said that her father coughed for a long time afterwards, which I think was just from the salt in the salt mines and the sort of the cold down there where they were working for it. But I think like just Gilbert Doan came back, and it was a time where they were trying to get funding to build Memorial Library. He had a lot going on. They were trying to get him back as soon as they could to get him working on things they needed here on campus. Jess Bell took a little while to decide to come from Washington, from the National Archives, back to Wisconsin and start working again for the Wisconsin Historical Society, and did decide to come back to the Midwest. So I think it did take them a while to probably acclimate back to what they were doing before the war, just like it does for anyone to come back from war to reacclimate.
Do you have a sense of how successful they were at retrieving this lost art and archives, about how that effort went?
I think they were fairly successful, probably not as successful as maybe as they had hoped to be. And again, it's somewhat hard to know because you don't really have one big comprehensive list of what was taken or stolen or destroyed.
You can't check pieces off your
list. Yeah, you can't really say, okay, we know that the Nazis took this from the Rothschild family. We know they took this from whatever family. And so, and I'm sure it's difficult to figure out how much you got. I think you have to be sort of happy with what you managed to save, and they did save an awfully lot.
Now, you saw the movie. Did it match up against what you just told me? Were there salt mines?
There were salt mines. Like I said, the movie's a little bit maybe more dramatic than it was in real life, but but it's a movie.
That's Hollywood for you.
Yes.
Well, do you think the UW left a legacy in its monuments men? Are we proud of this?
Oh, yeah. And I think it's an interesting for us. I mean, archivists, librarians, art historians don't get a lot of publicity, and a lot of, particularly in something like wartime. And so it's been very interesting for us, and to add some information. There's a monuments men website that they ask to add information to about the people, and we'll be able to do some of that.
All right. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was David Null, Director of Archives at the University of Wisconsin. We've been talking about the university's contribution to the Monuments Men world of World War II, and the topic has gotten attention lately with the release of the movie Monuments Men, directed by George Clooney.